Welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. Today's guest is Vern Gambetta. I've met Vern about 14 years ago when he came and spoke at a clinic, put on a clinic at South Florida when I was first starting off there. He is a pioneer in our field. He is a leader, puts out some great stuff both on his blog and through social media and getting out and speaking. He's authored 7 books. He's done countless DVDs. And he's just a huge resource for all of us. So today's guest, I know you're going to get a ton out of, Vern Gambetta. All right, real excited about our guest on the show today, Vern Gambetta. I've known Vern for, it was probably 13, 14 years ago that you did that clinic at South Florida. And I met him. And he's been a mentor of mine, a teacher. From afar, I've read pretty much everything he's put out, and he probably doesn't really understand or know the amount of influence he's had on me as a coach, but I'm very excited to have you on the show today. Welcome, Vern.
Well, thank you, Ron. It's good to be here, and those are kind words, because a lot of times you don't know if you've had influence, good or bad, so it's good to hear that. So
no question. Well, you definitely have. Great to hear, so. Well, hey, Vern, I was thinking as I was preparing for this, when you got in the field X number of years ago, it was quite a different landscape. Looked completely different than it does right now. Can you talk a little bit about why you got into the field and how that even was an option for you at the time?
Sure.
And then some of the things that you're seeing across the field now.
Yeah. Well, my pathway was probably real different than most young coaches coming in today. I was a fairly established coach in track and field. And as a track and field coach, both at the high school level in the 70s, this is my 44th year of coaching. The football coach would come to me, the volleyball coach, the basketball coach, because track and field is about getting faster, being more explosive. And, you do that. I never thought of it as being a strength and conditioning coach. And then when I was the women's track and field and cross country coach at Cal Berkeley, I want to say 81, they hired a guy to kind of do some of the strength training with football, and the women's department was separate, but kind of talked to the guy, and I certainly knew of what was going on with Bob Ward. Bob Ward had been a great track coach, and I followed him when he went, to the Dallas Cowboys, and actually was offered a job to take his place at the junior college where he had been coaching, which is kind of ironic. And so he was kind of the guy that I looked at. And I had gotten to know Al Vermeil when we were both high school coaches. And then I was coaching at Cal and went down and helped him with his high school program. Then he got the 49ers job and would have me over periodically to help him with the speed and kind of the conditioning and the periodization stuff. I'm a track coach. Well, I started looking about 82 and saying, I need to expand my horizons here. And I left the job at Cal. And anyway, to make a long story short, I never had any intention of being a strength and conditioning coach. And it was something that when he got the job with the White Sox and the Bulls, we had done enough together. He offered me an opportunity. And it was probably one of the few decisions I'd made kind of based on money as well as professional advancement. It was roughly almost twice the salary I was making as a high school coach. So it wasn't a hard decision. And I haven't looked back. I mean, I didn't have a particular passion for baseball. I'd done a lot with basketball before. I played basketball. But again, you get caught up in the moment. And then in 87, the White Sox approached me about doing it full time. And by that time, working in that environment for 2 years, I saw the perils and pitfalls. I saw what he was not able to do. And so we had a real forward-thinking general manager and scouting and farm director, the same person. And they wanted to do it right. And I said, fine. If you give me control and be in charge of the minor league trainers, in charge of rehab, in charge of my own budget, give me an R&D component. They did. Wow. And Larry, manager, says, we're going to have to pay you a lot. And I said, no, not up front, but in 2 years you will. And I did another thing that I'd recommend you all do is I wrote my own metrics for evaluation. Because they didn't know what it was. They didn't know what I was doing. Right. So I wrote my own metrics for evaluation, and I tied it was athletic trainers, ATCs, because they have to be the strength and conditioning coach, and my pay raises and that based on performance that I defined. So I, like you said, that was a different landscape, you know. Nobody was doing it. And pro football, there was probably no more than half the teams had strength and conditioning coach. Pro basketball, no more than a third. Pro baseball, 14, at Houston Astros had been the first guy. Really, that was about it. You know, so it was a different climate. That's a good way to say it.
No question. Well, having been in the field for a while, what qualities in a strength coach do you think best exemplify a successful one?
Well, the successful one is somebody, you know, knowledge is a given. I think the ability to transfer what we learn, and particularly today, given the career path, you know, what they learn in exercise and sports science classes to the field, you know, being practical. Are you practical? Can you get it done in the time, facilities, and space and personnel available? That's so important. And I think that most important is the ability to communicate. Ability to communicate with the athletes, get them on board with you, and communicate with the powers that be, whether it's the coaching staff, the administration, whomever. If I look back on the good moments of when that's when I did a good job. It's never been a big problem with athlete. It's, you know, more with the coaching staff and that. And when the rocky moments are when I didn't do a good job of that. You know, so that's what I really look for, because to me, knowledge is a given. I'd like to see, if I were hiring, I'd like to see, and Jim Ratcliffe and I have had many talks about this. Say I was in a D1 position or back in a position like with a pro team, I want to see coaching experience. And people say, well, I just got out of college. How can you expect coaching experience? And I go, well, did you ever coach a little league team? Right. Did you go back and help your high school football coach, your high school basketball coach? So you have to actually walk in the shoes of the coach that have to prepare the team for the game on Saturday or Thursday night. Because, Ron, that's the biggest deficiency that I see in the young strength and conditioning coach today. They don't quite understand what the coach that wears the hat of head coach at Tennessee or University of South Florida or the manager of the White Sox, that their butt's on the line. No, and we got to, you know, we're support staff. So, sorry. Well, I got a little off base there.
That's absolutely right. It's a big picture thinking. I think I agree with you 100%. Yeah. One of the biggest deficiencies is understanding that, yeah, you know, just because, you know, we think maybe the squat is the best thing in the world, all of a sudden a head coach comes down and maybe our star player got hurt squatting, he's going to be a little sensitive to that. And you're going to have to decide.
Somewhere in the past, somebody did.
No question.
And it's our job, too. I think the hardest part of this is educating. You know, you get a younger – I have the benefit now that I'm older and I have gray hair. And it's funny how people perceive you as different as opposed to when I was in my 30s or my 20s. You know, that now the stupid stuff that I used to say that was stupid is considered wise, you know. And I don't chuckle, but my point being is now I take a step back. I had a conversation with the swim coaches I was working with about, and what he was dancing around is he'd had a bunch of kids have shoulder problems from a particular exercise I was showing. And the exercise was taught wrong, the resistance was incorrect, the mode of resistance, and it was done at the wrong time of the year with the wrong age group. And so, you know, I was able to explain that in a non-emotional manner. He goes, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And now the exercise is in the right place at the right time with the right people, yeah, you know. So, you know, I don't know. It's the Henry Kissinger Award or something like that.
I hear you. You know, one of the challenges as I've gone through this profession, you know, I was, you know, fortunate that I was a Division I head strength coach at a very young age, and,
right,
you know, I've had the experience now. One of the things that I've really fought with as a strength coach is how do you, as a profession, we have not done a good job of defining the way to evaluate us.
Right.
And so it's almost not their fault, but at the same time, athletic directors, head coaches, they're making decisions on our jobs without really truly knowing how to evaluate us.
They don't know what we do. I mean, they'll come and, in my sense, what I've seen is they'll see a snapshot or, you know, instead of watching the whole movie. And I think it's imperative that all of us, as I said, educate. A friend of mine said it, and in a positive way, leave a paper trail, man. We got to leave a paper trail. We've got to make sure that the AD, the assistant AD, the fundraiser, all the coaches know what we do and how we go about doing it. I mean, went back, and this was a while ago, but I've done it again. I've done it with an international basketball team that I've worked with. I do it with the swim teams. I meet with all the coaching staff. I basically do a clinic. And I explain to them, soup to nuts, what they're going to see, when they're going to be sore. And you've worked in pro baseball, too. And we did this with the White Sox. The first day of coaches' meetings, we had a six-hour clinic. 3 hours of slides and movies. And 3 hours where these guys, these old and young, got up and they went through the movements. And I had the trainer, that were working with them. And, The number one thing is I didn't care whether they were for me. I wanted them neutral about the program, and we got advocates right away.
Right.
So I think the more I say this, it's the advice I give to my adult kids all the time, and I have a thing on my wall here, define yourself. And I think the mistake that we make as strength and conditioning coaches, first of all, I'd like to see the name change, because right away we label ourselves probably incorrectly by that term, right? And that's where you probably know this. I've tried to use the term athletic development, athletic performance, something like that. And in the rest, in Australia and England, a lot of the coaches have gotten into that, a lot of the rugby coaches, and it's changed the perception of how people look at them right away. Words create images, and images create action. Because strength, number one, we go strength and conditioning, we separate, right. And a big part of our job is integrating, and that. So I would recommend that young coaches and coaches when you get your next job, one of the first things, it's almost a negotiable point in the contract that you will define, the metrics for your evaluation, with obviously there's going to be, additional things that the administration's going to put in, but that you define your what are the performance metrics that are expected. Sure. And to me, just like we ask the athletes to make goals, they should be process items rather than outcome items. Not that I'm going to have everybody bench 400 or, you can do that.
Right.
And then you get yourself in a trap, but what are the process? I think clear communication with the athletic trainers is crucial. As you know, right now, there's too much of this and not enough of this.
Absolutely.
And it's power struggles. And, I had the opportunity to be out at Oregon for 4 days. There's a reason why they're doing some of the things they're doing, because Jimmy and his staff and the trainers work together. It's really and the other places around the world that I've seen it, again, the team that puts their best players on the field more often, provided they have better talent, and they're coached well, they're going to win. And that's a big part of our job,
right.
So anyway,
well, we were talking offline a little bit about just the other flip side of that coin is going in full-fledged as a member of the coaching staff.
Bingo.
And, instead of being the quarterback coach or the running back coach, you're the strength coach, and accepting the amount of instability that comes with that,
mm-hmm.
but also turn around and as a profession potentially say, mm-hmm. show me another coach on staff that deals with the number of kids and
number of kids during the length of time. Yeah, you. That's a great point, Ron. I forgot. I mean, we've spoken about it. I assume we were. Yeah, that you are, and you. It's not optional that you sit on a coaching meeting. It's required.
Yeah.
So when there's a staff meeting, you're there. Anytime anything comes up about conditioning, injuries, that, you're there. You disarm it before it ever leaves the room. Before the head coach makes an offhanded remark to the press about, oh, we've got a bunch of elbow soreness, you know, a manager made that remark one time,
yep.
You know, and that. So, and now it is. Some of these meetings are not fun to sit in. You know, you just kind of like prop your chin up and learn how to sleep with your eyes open because a lot of it doesn't relate to you. But on the other hand, when they're evaluating players and they're talking about putting in a new offense or something like that, you're thinking about, well, what do I need to do, in the weight room, on the track, on that to make adjustments, and then you can pipe in, and then pretty soon they're going to seek your input.
No question.
And same thing in terms of looking at talent ID. I know you can't go out and test guys, but you have relationships with high school strength and conditioning coaches. You're going to be able to find stuff out about kids, you know, that the coaching staff isn't,
no question.
And there's all kinds of things that you can do.
Well, I think
you
hit it right on the head with, you know, I think where we're at as a profession though, is we're split, you know, in that half our profession or whatever percentage you want to say is aligning themselves more as administrators and on that, you know, that athletic training type of model. The other half is really embedded with the coaching, you know, and so they have those great relationships, but you know it's almost there's no really give and take there. And so as a profession, I think we need to step back and we need to start to say, okay, where's the path that A, we're going to be able to create the most jobs, B, we're going to be able to keep the most amount of coaches in the profession, because as I've mentioned before, right now I think it's a fantastic job. I don't know if it's a great profession because there's not too many guys retiring doing what we're doing. You know?
No. Well, we have to define the profession.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, it's 20 really when you look at, I mean, I kind of look at the watershed mark right around 90, 92. You know, when basically, you know, most there was D1 schools in the 80s that didn't have strength and conditioning coaches in any sport. You know, so if you're looking at a relatively new and we have to have a profession, we have to be professional.
Absolutely.
You know, and we won't get off on certifications and that kind of stuff, but and we can't, and we are not personal trainers. We are coaches.
That's right.
You know, and we're not weight room supervisors. We're coaches. Yes, the administrative role for the head S&C or head athletic development goal is part of it, but you still are a coach. You know, if you want to be an assistant athletic director, then that's fine. Do that. But don't call yourself a coach then. You know, that means you've got to be there and be there sweating with everybody else and, you know, and doing that. Now it's, you know, you got an S on your chest when you assume that responsibility, you know, to head a department and still be a coach, but you got to do it because that's what's wrong with college athletics today. There's not an administrator. I can tell you the D1 schools that my friends coach at that are actually sport coaches, not an administrator has ever been a coach anymore. Okay. And in my day, every administrator had been a coach at some level. You know, so that's a problem.
That's definitely the challenge, no question. I agree with you 100%. Given that, you know, if you were to walk into a Division I setting now with those parameters, and you had 17 sports and you were responsible for, you're the head strength coach, maybe you're responsible for football, but you're also in charge of the department.
Mm-hmm.
What are you coming in saying, you know what, this is a must for me. This is how I need to structure my organization. You talk about championship organizations quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, the most important thing above all is personnel. I mean, I've got to have a budget where I can get the best people. Okay. That's number one. Facilities are a plus. Personnel trumps facilities. I think the biggest criticism, because remember, I don't work, you've worked a lot with football. I don't work, nor have I ever worked day to day with football. So I work with the other sports. with swimming, with track and field, with tennis, and football is a huge target of criticism. And I think we need to do a better job of integrating what is done in terms of developing athleticism, not always separating the football players, but sometimes when, like the 4 days I spent at Oregon, I watched the four groups of football work, and women's softball was in there one day. Baseball was in there another day. Track was in there the whole time. And it creates a unity of a team of university of fill in the blanks.
Right.
And you're the head coach of that, you know, of that segment. And a lot of head football coaches don't want to see that. But I think there's ways that we can blend and make better use of monies, facilities, time. Time is the second, right? That's one of your biggest issues, is fitting time relative to personnel, because you can't. Ideally, we talked about this in Houston. Ideally, I would have a strength coach, strength and conditioning, athletic development coach, literally embedded with each team. Or if not with each team, in other words, men's and women's basketball could have one coach and a couple of grad assistants. Baseball and softball could have one coach and one grad assistant. Men's and women's track, and you know, where you have a coach that really gets deep into that sport.
Yeah.
But then you want to utilize that expertise across sports, you know, too. So I don't know I sound like it's going to be a big mumbo jumbo mess, but to me, it's more how the personnel are utilized. And then what we do to open channels of communication, because as you know, the athletic trainers have a trainer assigned virtually to each team because of liability issues, don't
right.
they?
Yep.
Well,
absolutely.
You know, if we want to create more jobs and real jobs, we need to think about that in our profession too.
I agree.
And be meaningful.
I agree 100%. You know, kind of switching gears a little bit, you know, one of the things that I've always respected about you is it seems like every time I hear you speak, read something, You've got a system for everything. You've got a plan. You've got a template. You know,
it's
if not A, then it's B, then it's C, then it's D. You know, I see the books in the background there. I mean, how do you go about creating these systems and kind of just pulling from all these different resources?
I'm the luckiest guy in the world. In 1969, in California, you go 4 years to college and you have to get your teaching credential. Sometimes just blind, dumb luck. Stumbled. I'm from Santa Barbara. I went to Fresno State and went back, and they started a coaching minor program. I was the first graduate because I had all these units from undergrad, and there was a guy there that just came in named Sherm Button, and he'd been a high school PE teacher and track coach in Portland. He's into strength and conditioning. In my book, you never read about him. He's way ahead of Boyd Epley, all these people. I'm way ahead of him. And he had I could get up in a minute. I still have the book over here from the class, Harold Falls, Principles of Conditioning. Ron, we had to design, and I have it over here on the other bookshelf. My sport was track and field. We had to design a whole year conditioning program. If it was football, for every position in your sport. If it was, in my case, track and field. And that thing was, you can imagine, was 70 pages. Well, is the latest edition. I mean, every year I upgrade it, update it. Now it's part of my game manual, but that's what it is. It's
right.
Like you said. So there's a system to planning. There's a system to warm up. There's a system to speed development. And Dr. Button, Sherm Button, was the one that got me started on that path. And then it was also track and field. I mean, that's the way track thinks, you know, systematic approach. And the third thing is, as I got into being a track coach, I wanted to be the best track coach I could. And I looked around, and my measure of a coach is what you do with what you have. Okay, so you have a lot of talent. You don't do anything. They win championships. Big deal. I mean, that's good. You know, but I like to see coaches that maybe have not quite as much, but really get. And I looked at the Europeans, and I go, how come they're able to do some of the stuff that we're not doing in track and field? And then that led to weightlifting, to some of the other sports, and that idea of a system. Systems beat chaos, you know, is what it comes down to. So, and remember, I had a background playing college, sitting on the bench in college football. And again, you know, we played against San Diego State, Don Coryell's great teams, and he had a system. And I saw that. I saw that on tape. You could see what they were doing, and that stuck in my head. That, you know, you can that you take that into any aspect of coaching. So that's where it comes from. So,
you know, that's one of the things that I always tell my staff is every one of them. You know, we had at Tennessee, we had a staff of 15 people. Wow. You know, there's one strength coach, you know, one head strength coach.
Yeah.
You know, but every one of them, you know, you don't get in this business to be an assistant. You know, you get in this business to be a head strength coach.
Right.
And obviously their respect, you know, they have their sports and they're the head strength coach for their sports and this, that, and the other. But, you know, I would always tell them that they need to create a program, you know, as they go through. You know, maybe they're not writing the program for this sport, that sport, or the other sport. But, you know, but right now they might as well be creating those manuals and those systems. And so that way they're prepared for when they do come across an opportunity where they're working with that sport or they're having to go into an interview and, you know, sit down with that track coach or that golf coach and be able to present a program.
Right. Well, an example would be, I've asked coaches, and I'll use Tennessee as an example, but how many, and maybe she wouldn't allow it, but when, you know, how many of your coaches got to sit and watch Pat Summitt's practice from start to finish?
Yeah.
You know, how many, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, in my coaching career, and just I'm talking in the last 6 months, I have seen not just Jim Ratcliffe, but all over the world. It has been like taking me, whatever level I am, I feel like I've improved about 5% to 10% just by watching other people coach, you know,
absolutely.
Passively watching. No, it's not. I never passive, but you know what I'm saying. I'm getting fired up.
Well, that's a great point. Is it's not just strength and conditioning; it's getting outside of your comfort zone.
Oh, it's coaching,
exactly. No, that's a great point.
Right.
One of the things that I've always tried to do throughout my career is try not. You know, I've tried not to make the mistakes of my the people that have come before me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've tried to look and see where mistakes have been made and then also things that have been, you know, maybe catalysts for having success. You know, examples being, you know, mentoring young coaches. That's a catalyst for success or speaking or writing or whatever. You know, what are some mistakes that maybe you've made through your career or maybe some of those, you know, that you've learned from that you could pass along? Or what are some of those catalysts that we could all get better in?
Well, probably the biggest one I've been preaching a lot the last couple of years because it's really as I look and I keep a lot of training records is no one workout can make an athlete, but one workout can break an athlete. So the workout always has to be in context. And where that, the bigger principle behind that is, I think sometimes it's real easy to kind of zero in and focus on a microcycle or focus on a phase and not recognize that training accumulates. I mean, we just... In the last 2 weeks, with these three of the swim clubs that I'm working with, that came home to roost. And the other day down here with the Sarasota Sharks, the swim coach basically got done talking to swimmers just exactly what I'd said. You know, he said at the end of a strength endurance phase of 4 weeks, it would, you know, and they were at the end of an endurance phase in swimming, it was easy. So you know that part of it. I wrote down. Oh, one other thing, too heavy too often. You know, you get caught up in the strength coach mode and not that lighter is better, but I one of the things that I see looking back on my own career and some of this I learned in track that we just kept those heavy cycles too long. And, you know, 3 to 6 weeks. And then as the athlete grew, literally a college kid, when they're seniors, they don't have to go a 6 week cycle on some of the heavy stuff. They're going to be able to bring that right back up to a high level with six. Being really heavily influenced lately over the years by Bondarchuk on that idea.
Yeah.
And too heavy too often will dull the nervous system. So you'll get really good max strength numbers, but you lose some of the explosiveness and you lose some of the coordinated capacities. So that's a big part of it. And last but not least, as I said earlier, it's not about an exercise, because I chuckle a lot of times been on panels and they'll say, what's your favorite exercise? Yeah, okay, well, my favorite exercise to do is not necessarily what, you know, because I'm a 66-year-old man. I mean, I squat all the time. I need to, all right? I mean, I don't always squat with weight on my back. I don't, but it's not necessary for all my athletes to squat all the time, you know, and equipment, you can get caught up because you spent $10,000 for a piece of equipment, marry into the equipment. I've done that, whether it's a testing device, whether, you know, and everything's directed toward that. And then facilities. And some of the best coaching I've ever done have been, I mean, I worked with Venice High School girls volleyball for 4 years. Great bunch of young ladies. The first 2 years we trained in the parking lot. They were awesome. They were awesome. I mean, they didn't look any different than when we had the really nice, you saw the pictures of the nice weight room, you know, and it's 88, 92 degrees here. And you know, and there's a certain amount of grit that they got from that, you know. So when we got to the weight room, that was really cool. We have real weights to lift now.
That's right.
Anyway, so
my wife and I.
And enjoy it. Above all, that's the other thing. That this goes over the 44 years. Enjoy it. Man, every day that we can work with young people, we're really lucky because we get a chance. The thing about what we do sometimes over the football, basketball, even the track coach, is we can see bigger improvements faster than they can on some of the qualities that we're able to work on, which is really exciting.
That's a great point. Yeah, that reminds me of a story. My wife and I, we adopted our kids from the Ukraine. And so while we were there, I went and watched the national team train.
Oh, yeah.
And you go into the training hall, and here's some, you know, I mean, world-class, unbelievable weight being thrown around, and it's being done on a piece of plywood.
Yeah.
You know? And you're right, absolutely get caught up in facilities. Yeah. But Vern, I know you're busy, man. I appreciate you coming on. What are some ways that everybody can stay in touch with you and talk about some of the programs that you have?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one that I'm really proud of, and it's kind of, I wanted to do this. Obviously, there's a business part of it too, but it's called my GAIN Apprenticeship. GAIN stands for Gambetta Athletic Improvement Network. And it's a five-day school. We go literally, it's crazy. We go from 6 in the morning formally till 9 at night, and then people stay up half the night talking. At Rice University this year, it's June 11th to the 15th, and I've got a top-notch faculty, maybe not some of the names. Jim Radcliffe's kind of the headliner from the strength and conditioning world. We'll have Nick Folker, who's the aquatic strength and conditioning coach at Cal Berkeley, and if anybody followed sport, they have two NCAA champs, bunch of Olympians. Bill Knowles on the rehab side, who's rehabbed some of the top athletes in the world. Ed Ryan used to be head of USLC Sports Medicine. Anyway, the idea is you come and it's a coaching school, and then you're part of the network, so you pay the tuition. You're part of the network, and you have access to a terrific online library, secure videos of different workouts that we all share, and just interviews, and then a forum that people come on, you know, share workouts, thoughts, ideas, and that. So if anybody's interested, just, you know, contact me through my email, which is gstscoach@gmail.com. There's a GAIN Network Facebook page, you know, and that too. And that's really where I put a lot of my efforts each year, Ron. And then you know, I do a blog, functionalpathtraining.typepad.com. I try to write it pretty much every day, you know. And I when I get brain cramps, I put tweets up, you know, and those are usually related to something about coaching or an observation of something I've seen. Coaching's my life. You know, I have, you know, I'm not apologizing. I love coaching, and that's what I do. So I try to share the information. And you said earlier, great point, because I've been fortunate to have some great mentors, and a couple of them took me on early on and said, you don't have to make the mistakes that I made. You know, and that's kind of one of the themes with the GAIN Apprenticeship. Man, you get up and you listen to Jim Radcliffe talk, who's at the top of his field, and talk about things that he did 15, 20 years ago that he did at a high school coach that you know, you learn from your mistakes. So we get some of us are real smart because you made a lot of them. You know? So,
I hear you.
If you learn, so.
That's absolutely right. Anyway, we also have the website gambetta.com, and
right.
You know, athletic development, the book is phenomenal. You know, yeah. And so I'd highly recommend that as well.
But okay.
Vern, I truly appreciate you coming on, man. We'll make sure to link all that stuff up. But thanks a lot for spending time with us.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Anytime. Take care, Ron. Thank you. Good luck.
A couple of quick announcements before we let you go. Make sure that you look down below the video to find any of the links that we mentioned. We always try to link that stuff up for you to make it easy for you just to be able to click and get to any of those links. Also, if you are a young strength coach and you are looking to get into this field, maybe you've done an internship, maybe you are looking to do an internship, Strength Coach Basic Training is basically an online internship program that I created when, way back when I had a lot of coaches that could not make it down to intern with me. Our internship program's done very, very well. We've had a lot of people go on, have quite a bit of success in the field, and you can kind of scroll through Strength Coach Basic Training. But essentially, it's 8 lectures that are designed to kind of just prep you for some of the things that you typically don't get when you intern, you know. And so, you know, checkpoint one's building the strength and conditioning cover letter, resume, references, using social media to network, doing site visits, building the library, the history of strength and conditioning, you know, my philosophy and how it's principle-based, not philosophy-based, time management tactics and facility design. And these are the things that maybe aren't the sexy things, the programming and those types of things. But they're the things that help you organize your thoughts in a way to have success when you go to look for positions. So check out strengthcoachbasictraining.com, and we'll see you next time on the show.